When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
This week we head to Cambodia and the ancient ruin known as Angkor Wat. We're joined by research investigator Dr. Edwin Bernard and his team, who did some significant studies there in 2010 in a light phenomenon known as the Zenith Passage. This is a high point in a solar calendar where the sun is at its highest point. And the ancients apparently studied this phenomenon to the point of building temples to honor and to capture the sunlight. This is something that is brand new. It's cutting-edge technology, and we have a firsthand report on just what happens to these temples during these times of year. All this and more on Earth Ancients. Saturday, June 4th, 2022. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, how you doing? Hope you're doing well today. I'm not 100%. I mean, this trip's been, we've been back for 2 weeks now, and I gotta tell you, I didn't take enough cell salts, and we typically give our tour groups electrolytes after the flight, and I had some with me, but I didn't bring enough for everybody, and you know, a lot of people were fatigued, because you're talking about 100-110 heat on some of the places we went to in Egypt. But typically, when we do the Earth Ancients tours, especially in Mexico, I bring a couple of different hydration packets. One is, it's called Tactical Hydration. The other one that's made for athletes is called LMNT, and they're powder packs, and they're excellent for electrolyte and hydration supplementation. And I'll tell you, the other thing is, when we do our Mexico group, especially when we're in Mexico City, that's 5,000 feet above sea level, and those electrolytes really help balance your equilibrium so that you can begin to get a sense of where you're at. Some people occasionally get altitude sickness at high elevations, and these salts really can help the body recover from the changes in altitude, especially when you're in places like Machu Picchu or Cusco, Peru. Typically, we fly into Lima, we relax a little bit for a few hours, and then when we fly into Cusco, people definitely need to have their electrolytes. It takes about 24 hours. When you use these designer electrolytes and hydration packets, they're basically cell salts. And so in Egypt, we didn't have enough this time. And so I gave out what I had to people who were not 100% on arrival. And, you know, you naturally adjust. And your body naturally comes back into equilibrium when you're there, because it's you know, it's not a high elevation, but it's very warm. And the other thing about traveling in foreign countries is if it's a hot location, you can end up drinking too much water and flushing your minerals out, and you can get lightheaded. So everybody is different. Everybody takes time to acclimate. And I had to make a mental note of this, that in the future, I'm going to bring enough for everybody in the group to have 2 days worth of salts to hydrate, to adjust to the new settings. The bigger issue on these tours, especially in Egypt, is for me in California, it's over 22 hours. That is, I'm finding that I'm challenged by that. And so it's important to get a comfortable seat. For me, it's an aisle seat. I mentioned to everybody who I tour with in my notation that it's critical to get, if you can, an upgrade to economy premium, which is between the business and economy class. Or, and some people do this, they just upgrade to business and be done with it. So you got to be very comfortable, very relaxed. It's a long flight, and you got to be cognizant of getting on a plane for that long. Some of these big jets, they'll put you in like cattle. And if you're in those four seat rows in the middle, and you're in the middle of that row, that is, can be a challenge. So for me, as I get older, it's really critical to prepare and sell salts. Also, bringing your vitamins makes the tour and the travel much more doable, much more comfortable. And I came home and I didn't take enough vitamins and I didn't take enough cell salts. So it took a little longer to recover. In fact, I had, like I think I mentioned, I had the effects of a cold, and I had a little bit of flu-like symptoms as well. But I'm back in the saddle and feeling much better. So anyhow, as a reminder, our Mexico trip is going to be the Labor Day week, September 2nd to the 12th. And this is a great opportunity to see many of the ancient Mayan ruins, pyramidal buildings and structures that we will visit and climb on. And for more information, go to earthancients.com/tours. It's really fun. We have a great time. And exploring is really part of Earth Ancients. So hope you can join us. Hey, this week we are featuring a remarkable study done on Angkor Wat temples. And this is with our friend Dr. Edwin Barnard. He, with a group of university students, went out to Angkor Wat in Cambodia and we're studying the Zenith Passage. And we're going to hear about what this is. Ed has sent me the actual report and details of his research, which was conducted in 2010. It's in the form of a PDF graph. I will post it on the Facebook page for you to be able to follow along with today's program. And it is 22 pages of exacting detail on not only how the Mesoamerica, specifically the Maya, sanctified and worshipped the sun, but also how apparently the Khmer, an ancient culture in Cambodia who built Angkor Wat, created their temples to not only capture the sun, but to enhance it and also deliver it into the interior of these ceremonial temples, which align a good deal of Angkor Wat. Now, this is something that I have not heard about before. And when you hear what he's talking about, this is something that is even surprising for an archaeologist to consider, but this is why we have Ed on the show. He is not your typical archaeologist. He breaks the mold on a number of different levels, and today we're going to hear just what he discovered with his team And this seasonal event known as the Zenith Passage, civilizations like the Maya, like the Khmer, that are in the region known as the Tropic of Cancer area, and this is where the sun is the most direct at two or three times a year. So this is our program. Now, I have a short introduction to Angkor Wat, who built it, what the purpose was. This is a very good introduction to Angkor Wat that you can have a quick listen to.
Angkor Wat, the largest temple on Earth. This massive structure dominates the jungle landscape of northern Cambodia. But for centuries, its sandstone towers and carved walkways were lost to the forest, hidden beneath an impenetrable canopy of trees. Now, archaeologists investigating Angkor Wat are revealing its hidden secrets. Workers have cleared the trees to reveal a temple complex, covering over 500 acres. And there could be more. Archaeology teams use innovative laser technology to hunt for the long-lost city they believe must once have surrounded Angkor Wat. Other experts search for clues inside the temple to solve the mysteries of how and why it was built.
It's perfection in terms of carving, it's perfection in terms of dimensions, in terms of rhythm of spaces within the temple. This required an extraordinary vision.
Ancient architects designed Angkor Wat to inspire awe and wonder. A majestic staircase led pilgrims to a magnificent central atrium, where they came face to face with Vishnu, a supreme being in the Hindu faith. Five imposing stone towers rose above their heads, symbolizing the sacred Mount Meru, home of the gods. Built using 500,000 tons of stone, Angkor Wat is a spectacular recreation of heaven on earth. But why did the ancient Cambodians build this temple so much bigger than any other? Simon Warwick has spent decades investigating Angkor Wat and its surrounding temples. He believes the answer to this mystery lies in decoding the intricate carvings that adorn the temple walls.
We're in the third enclosure of the Temple of Angkor Wat, and in this enclosure we have more than half a mile of carved bas-reliefs.
The carvings tell the story of the ancient civilization who built the temple, the Khmer. They depict the army's military victories, and they give us an image of a great ruler, King Suryavarman II.
So here we are in front of King Suryavarman II himself. This is the first portrait of a Khmer king in the history of Khmer art. Here he is sitting on his throne, looking very regal, surrounded by his counselors and his ministers, several holy men, and wonderful umbrellas to shield him from the sun, fans, fly whisks, all the accoutrements of royalty are here.
Critically, King Suryavarman wasn't born to rule. He had seized power from his great uncle. And Simon is convinced that Angkor Wat's huge size was a grand political statement to win over his new subjects.
Carved here is the message that the king wanted to get to his people. In a way, this is the campaign ad for Suryavarman II.
Suryavarman didn't just want to be seen as a rightful king. He wanted to be revered as a god. So he built a temple with an extraordinary secret that links it to the heavens. Each year at the spring equinox, the sun rises directly over the central tower. A hole in the capstone focuses the sunlight down into the temple. It shines through a hole in the floor below, and down a 90-foot shaft to a secret chamber deep underground. Some experts believe that Suryavaman designed this secret vault to hold his mortal remains. If they're right, Angkor Wat is not just a temple. It's a spiritual machine to elevate the god king to his rightful heavenly throne.
That beam of light the narrator is speaking of is the actual zenith passage that we'll be discussing today. And what makes these temples just mind-blowing is the fact that they were designed to not only capture the light from the zenith passage, this high point of the sun hitting the earth, but actually reflecting it and intensifying it as it passes through the interior of a hollow temple chamber into the floor and below. So this is the program we will feature today with Dr. Edwin Barnard, the Zenith Passage.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
So this week we're welcoming back Dr. Edwin Barnard to talk to us about some exploration he's done. Dr. Ed is one of my favorite people. He's a Mayanist. He is based in Texas, but we will tell people that you will be in Colorado very soon, probably in the next year. That will be your new digs. But hey, Ed, welcome back to Earth Ancients. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
We should let people know you just took a long drive, so you got a little... You've been driving for the last, I guess, couple of days, and you're now.
It's true. I just landed in our new place in Colorado to fix it up, but I'm ready to talk. Let's do it.
Excellent. Hey, well, this paper that you sent me is called "The Importance of the Zenith Passage at Angkor, Cambodia." Angkor Wat. Fascinating paper. I didn't know that it was a topic of discussion. Let's go back a little bit into the Mesoamerica view of the Zenith Passage. What is the Zenith Passage, first of all, and what reference do the Maya have for it?
Well, first off, we'll start with just what it is, because really, us Westerners, we're totally unfamiliar with this phenomena. It's stations of the sun. Basically, when the sun is directly over your head and it's casting absolutely no shadow. So if you look down, you have no shadow at zenith passage when the sun is directly overhead. But that only happens in the tropics. So above 23.5 degrees north and below 23.5 degrees south, there are no zeniths. So everywhere in the United States, you actually will never see the sun directly over your head. Okay. So it's, you know, the big solar stations that we all are familiar with are the solstices and the equinoxes, right?
Right.
Both of them happen twice a year. The zenith is another phenomena that only happens in the tropics. So the cultures that developed, the civilizations that developed in the tropics, saw that phenomena as well. But the other places, which include all of Greece, all of Rome, most of Egypt, except for the most southern part of Egypt, all of those are outside of the tropics. So places like Stonehenge, they never even thought about that in their astronomical observation because it didn't exist. So that's part of it. But it's also very interesting in that it changes from latitude to latitude. So if the day of zenith passage at Chichen Itza, let's say, is August 17th, it won't be zenith passage everywhere, just at that one latitude. So let's say I think it's about 19 degrees. Let's just say I don't have that off the top of my head, but
okay.
Let's say it's at that line at 19. The next day, the true zenith passage is only going to be happening at about 20 miles south of there. And the next day, it'll be 20 miles south, further south. So
okay.
Each latitude has its own zenith passage. So it's a weird phenomena that the Maya definitely were looking at. It's an odd thing. If you're a bunch of astronomer priests and everybody across the Maya world saw summer solstice happen on the same day on June 21st, and winter solstice at December 21st, and the equinoxes, everybody across the Maya world saw it. But when they look at the zenith passage, they say, hey, did you guys see that zenith passage on, you know, August 17th? No, that didn't happen that date for our city. It happened, August 25th. And so they realized that it was latitude dependent, this particular solar phenomena.
Talk a little bit about this cosmological perspective that the Maya had. In other words, a lot of their buildings are set on cardinal points and designed to actually capture the solstices and the equinoxes. Do we have a specific building, say, like at Chichen Itza, you mentioned, does the main pyramid El Castillo align to this zenith passage in some manner?
There is a it does relate, yes. And we have another paper about that on Maya Exploration Center's website.
Okay.
We talk about zenith passage in various places. It's not exactly aligned to it. What it is from the top of it, looking out over the ball court, I think it is, it sets. Okay. The sun sets on the day of zenith passage right behind the ball court from the top of it.
Okay.
So sometimes the Maya alignments are tricky. It's not just as simple as we're looking a building looking straight at the sun. It's okay. Hold on. I got to turn off something so it doesn't bing on us.
But I mean, if we look at other places other than Chichen Itza, we know Chichen Itza especially with the main pyramid, we have the spring equinox when we see the undulating serpent.
Right, which is at a cross angle, right? That's
it's
not
a cross angle.
It's an interesting way they oriented it to capture the sun at an angle.
Yeah, you also mentioned, is it Milta in Oaxaca? One of the figures aligned to it or something. Some of the other structures that are known to be old Mesoamerican buildings have seemingly positioning for the Zenith Passage.
Well, at Monte Albán, there's a very interesting, there's building J, which is oriented different than everything else, which should be astronomical, but we're actually still trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. But if you go, it's kind of shaped like an arrow, so it points in a direction, but that direction means nothing. But if you go backwards from that arrow, go from where the arrow, not from where the arrow is pointing, but where you might be an observer, and go draw a line back onto the next building that it hits away from building J, it mm-hmm. lands right on a place that we have what we call a zenith tube. That oh, there is a those. Built yeah. in, it's built into the staircase, and it's a shaft that really narrows the focus of light. So only when the sun is directly overhead does it cast this really strong circle, a beam of light onto the floor of that zenith passage chamber. Yeah. And so there's a weird relationship between the building. We're not really sure what it's looking at, but it has to be astronomical, and a place where someone would observe the zenith. There are two ways to really look at a zenith. You can use a gnomon, which is basically just a straight stick in the ground. And so the higher it is, the better it is, the taller it is. When you set it up perfectly plumb on the day of zenith, it'll have no shadow. Or you can make a zenith passage chamber, which is a long, narrow tube where the light gets through all the way through the tube only when it's coming from it directly above. There's one at Monte Albán and there's one at Teotihuacan.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of the one.
And one at Xochicalco.
Oh, really?
There's three of them. Xochicalco, Teotihuacan, and Monte Albán.
No, I have not heard until this paper of the Zenith Passage, and I'm wondering, these are the kind of things that archaeology splintered off in the 1960s and developed the archaeoastronomy branch simply because of these kinds of phenomenon. But can we take it a little further? And this is not necessarily your comfort zone. This seems like a very, very, this is a zenith passage seems like a very, very important period because it's so short a time span and such a powerful direct beam of sunlight. Are there shamanistic rituals that we know about that the Maya performed? Are there ceremonies? Are there rites of passage? What do we know about this?
Well, it is frustrating that when we try to get to the why they're doing these things, there almost certainly were rituals, but we don't know what they were. We know that people in the Guatemalan highlands say that they watch on their latitude. They watch for zenith passage as a sign that they should start planting their corn. It's one of the points important in which they plant their corn.
So agricultural, that's
vital to everything.
Yeah.
Religiously and just practically speaking. And there's also a really interesting thing that happens in that same place, the Guatemalan highlands, that line at, I think it's 15.6 degrees north latitude. Zenith passage breaks up the solar year into two different segments, 260 days and 105 days. I'm on one of these new desks and I accidentally moved it up. Sorry, I distracted myself. So I was saying right at 15.6, which is the latitude of Copan and a couple of other important sites, Izapa. It breaks up the year into a 260-day period, which is the sacred calendar for the Maya, and 105 days, which they say there is the gestation period for corn.
Okay.
So they say there are people who believe that the Maya calendar was actually created at that latitude because zenith was doing this special thing, dividing, like separating out the sacred year out of the solar year.
Wow. So it was extremely important. Is it reflected in like the Dresden Codex or any of the codexes that we have left to us? Is there any sense of this Zenith passage?
You know, in the codexes, I don't think I've seen any information like that. What we need is a hard date. And oftentimes we don't have hard dates in the codexes. In fact, pretty much period, we don't. We have lots of cycles that could be reused in any time period. So we'd need a date in order to evaluate whether they were talking about Zenith passage, and we'd need a location. It wouldn't be good enough to just say, oh, they're talking about August 13th. That's Palenque's Zenith passage, because maybe it was written in Chichen Itza. We don't know that. We don't know where any of them were actually originally written.
Okay. But the people like Linda Shealy and the other, people who mentored you as a student, how important did they relate to you that this Zenith passage was to the Maya? Was it like as big a deal as, say, the spring equinox or the solstices? I mean, how important do you think it was?
Well, you know, we're still trying to piece that together. When I was a student of Linda Shealy's, that was when she was writing Maya Cosmos, and she herself was coming up with the idea of just how important the solar passages in general were. But so we kind of stumbled on this Zenith passage thing together.
Wow.
And we see it more and more as we go forward. Ivan Sprock's work at EDSNA has a lot of interesting connections of Zenith passage alignments. That's one of the really weird ones that really...
I want to talk about that later. You're right. You actually talk about some of that. We'll get into that later.
Okay.
One of the things I really enjoy about your work, Ed, is that you don't stay in one place. You decided that you were going to go to Cambodia with an associate, Christopher Powell, in 2010 and 2011. And you went to Angkor Wat with a group to discover what their relationship was to the Zenith passage. Talk a little bit about what inspired you to get up and because that's not a short flight. That's a long flight. That's probably like 20 hours, at least a minimum of 20 hours. What was the motivation to go to Cambodia?
Well, it was the Zenith passage. You know, at that point, we had really been finding more and more and more evidence in the Maya area that they were observing and talking about Zenith passage. And so, you know, we pulled out a world map and said, well, what other cultures would be talking about Zenith? And when you pull out a world map and look at it and look for major civilizations that were just within the tropics, the list is really narrow. It's basically India and Southeast Asia.
The Tropic of Cancer, the ban is what you're saying.
Right. Well, there's the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. Those two at 23 and a half degrees north and 23 and a half degrees south, they create the band that we call the tropics.
So you looked within the band to see what other ancient cultures may have been interested in this Zenith passage.
And so the Khmer people in Cambodia were a total bullseye. And we had already been thinking, wow, you know, their buildings look similar. They have pyramids like the Maya do. I wonder if, and they're using basically a Hindu / Buddhist tradition of knowledge, which was very, very strong in terms of Zenith. We knew it was happening a little bit in India. So we went to go see whether we could see it in the temples anywhere in Angkor, in the Khmer civilization.
I want those of you listening to understand that what we're talking about in this paper, which is entitled The Importance of Zenith Passage at Angkor, Cambodia, is the only paper of its kind. I did a search on the internet, and Ed and Chris both put together this paper, and no one else is talking about this, and I think it's fairly important. So what do we know about the Khmer culture, Ed? Obviously, they decided that the pyramidal buildings were of importance to them. What, obviously you're there for the Zenith Passage, but what else attracted you? Was it the pyramidal cultural focus, or just that they seemed to be fairly sophisticated in the way that they viewed things?
Well, I think really, first and foremost, it's the monumentality. I mean, it's hard to wrap your mind around just how huge the city of Angkor is. Angkor Wat is just one temple complex within the larger city of Angkor.
Right.
We now know that its population around 1200 was approaching 1 million people. It was in the like 900,000s. That's huge. There's a section called Angkor Thom that's 3 kilometers by 3 kilometers. And that's just one section of the city. And I overlaid the map of Tikal on that. And all of Tikal would fit in just Angkor Thom.
Oh, it's huge, isn't it?
It's so much larger than anything that I ever have worked on in the Maya area. I was drawn to just see these massive ancient structures. But there's also a continuity of culture that attracts me. The people that live there are still Buddhist, and the things that are on the temple walls still mean something in the religion they're currently pursuing. So the continuity of culture there is fascinating and beautiful to me.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. I'd love to go there. I haven't been there yet. The Zenith Passage happens at Angkor on August 17th and April 21st. You were there. When were you there?
August both times.
August both times, right. Talk a little bit about these temples that you found. And I was blown away in your description. At one time, they were peaked with a special top ornament that was open to allow the sun to come in. And what you did is you went around. Apparently, looters had knocked off the top of these temples. And you actually found the tops later around.
They are just laying around in the jungle next to these big, beehive looking temples.
Right.
They're shaped like a beehive. Up on top, they had those capstones, and they're sitting there in the woods. I found them in a number of places. They're kind of stacked like blocks. So they have a couple of elements. There's a really pretty top that looks like a lotus. Like a lotus flower. And then there's a couple of little discs with a hole, but every one of them have a hole in the middle. The interior of those beehive shaped temples is totally hollow. And then, so it all allows the light to, in a very focused way, beam down onto the altar inside each one of these temples.
Yeah.
Only on Zenith Passage though. It was so fun when I first figured out that this was going to happen. I was in one temple inside Angkor Thom called the Bayon, and the Bayon has 52 of those big honeycomb or beehive temples.
Yeah.
So it was like a laser light show when it happened. But just before it happened, I went into one of the deep, dark ones. And each one of those altars have a nun or a monk who's sitting there all the time, lighting incense and just kind of tending it. So I went into a deep, dark one and said to the nun there, I said, "Hey, are you ever in here?" And all of a sudden, the whole chamber lights up. It's all of a sudden really lit and the sun's coming from above. And she said, "Yeah, that does happen sometimes." I said, "Do you know what's going to happen today?" She said, "What?" "Well, it's going to happen today." I said, "Yeah, in like 20 minutes, I'll come back." And so I came back 20 minutes later and she was just standing there with her mouth hanging open going, "How did you know that?" But it lit the temple up and it was like a laser light show inside of it. And it was an exciting day to find that was actually happening.
I got to say this, your pre-analysis of the reasons to go there was to find the ruins of Zenith Passage features in these temples. And you list the following. Talk a little bit about the following. So you just spoke about the nomads, which are the device that is the alignment device. The next device is a sighting tube. We kind of talked a little bit about Mount Albon, but the sighting tube at Angkor is the top of these temples, and they're basically hollow, and there's no obstructions all the way to the floor, right?
No obstructions. In fact, there's the reason that the looters knocked the tops off is because there's a jewel box in the top. There's a little box with jewels inside of it, but even that has a hole going through it, so the light is not blocked, so it can come all the way down in.
Why would they put precious jewels at the top of the pyramid?
I don't know. It's so fascinating.
And that is weird.
You know, badly thought out. I guess when the city was there, that was wonderful. I wonder whether it somehow, like, did they shine when the light came through? Did it do something special? I wish I could go up there and put one back together. I've been asking the Cambodian government to put them back together.
Really? To kind of reconstruct
the jewel box. I don't know, but they should put those caps back on so it works perfect.
Yeah. Okay. So the light comes through. This is the fundamentals of this zenith passage. Light comes through the top, goes through the interior of the temple, hits the floor, and at the floor there's a lingam. And I'll talk a little bit about lingam, which is the male and female genitalia in a symbolic shape of sculpture. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. It's an altar in our, you know, vernacular. So it's a basically square shaped altar. And in the center of the altar is a phallus. You know, we'd call it a phallus. There's a phallic symbol sticking straight up, looking, you know, pointing directly at the hole in the roof.
Right.
And so it's at the center of this yoni linga complex. The altar below is the yoni or the vagina, and then right. the phallus sits
on top of it.
Right. Okay. And so the light comes and beams directly down on that sculpture, right on the top of the phallus.
Okay.
And lights it up. Now that in some temples, I should say, some of them have those. Some of them have other objects standing in that center part. Some of them, there's one that has in the front of Angkor Wat, there's one that has a big statue of Vishnu that gets lit up. And in the center of Angkor, there is no Angkor Wat, I should say, that its biggest temple is actually the tomb of Savarman the Seventh. And the light in there comes through, but it hits the floor where there's a hole. And then there's a shaft that goes down 70 feet to the sarcophagus. And the sarcophagus has a hole. The light Weird. Actually comes from the top, goes down and touches the body of the king.
This is indicative of some importance of light, which is a vibration. We probably just have lost the understanding of why this light passage is treated in such reverence. Don't you think? Don't you think we're missing something?
Well, I mean, I don't know about the energy of the light, but what I think is happening, which I say at the end of that paper, is I think they're trying to recreate the center of the universe through these things. We've known for a long time that those honeycomb shaped or those that beehive shaped temples are models of Mount Meru out of Hindu myth, where the gods and the demons stir up this mountain, and that's where the elixir of life comes out of. But that Mount Meru is at the center of the universe. So we already know that those temples are saying they're the center. So my thinking is they want to do zenith passage because, I mean, if you tried to point at the center of the universe, where would you point? You'd probably point straight up. I think they are incorporating that universal center with the architecture that's symbolically Mount Meru at the center of the universe.
That's kind of like the Maya building pyramids in reproducing small mountains. That's kind of like their philosophy, which is kind of weird. It's kind of parallel to them.
Well, it was. It's absolutely parallel. That's when Shealy passed away. Her next book was going to be about what she called Tolans. And she said that the Maya and the other Mesoamerican cultures were attempting, when they built these cities, they were making them symbolically the center of the world, a place called Tolan, a place called of Cattail Reeds.
Right.
But they were basically everywhere they built was symbolically the center. Same thing that the Khmer were doing. Everything is symbolically the center, which is doesn't make any sense to my Western mind, but I will say that it connects very nicely to what our modern physicists are saying about the universe, that everything is moving away from each other at a constant speed. That basically means that everywhere is the center. That's what the Maya and the Khmer are saying. And our scientists are saying the same confusing thing.
As a side note, I have read different reviews. There's I think she's a Guatemalan archaeologist who recently suggested that Tikal has the same alignment in their buildings that a certain constellation has. Do we see that in Angkor Wat at all, where they're aligning buildings maybe are similar to a constellation that we know about?
You mean the arrangement of the buildings
and the pyramids?
Like the pyramids of Egypt are said to be the three belt stars of Orion?
Exactly.
Right. No, to my knowledge, I haven't seen, and I've done a lot of studying on that regard. I've seen some people try to suggest that that whole cities might be arranged like that. But in terms of inside the sites themselves, send me that paper if you find it, because I'm always looking for new stuff like that.
I reported on her discovery, I think about a year ago. She came out, I think it's Guatemala University or something like that. But
and she says there's like an arrangement. I wrote a whole paper about this. The Sioux do it. There are lots of cultures that do it. I said celestial space mirroring, or terrestrial space mirrors celestial space.
It's kind of the as above, so below thinking.
Yeah.
As the, you know, but she has, I think she called it the, and I haven't been to Tikal in a long time. It's the main civic area. Those pyramids, buildings, and other structures are aligned with a constellational body in the heavens. So I'll send it to you.
Hmm. Well, you know, there is, I guess, the one repeatedly very strong one is the triad form of the Maya pyramids, when they put them in a triangle form, three pyramids together, like Palenque's cross group and like the North group and Tikal, it's all over the place. That is said to be the three hearthstones. And, you know, the microcosm is the house of the modern Maya people. They're just, you know, or an ancient too. Three stones are the hearth of the house. The Comal sits in the middle of them, but they're also the constellation that's the two bottom feet stars and one of the belt stars of Orion. Those are the three hearthstones. So in that regard, I mean, almost every Maya city is mirroring celestial space.
And those were purposely designed architecturally to follow that format, right?
I mean, absolutely. That triad form.
It's none of that's random. They're actually specifically designing their civic area and their sacred buildings to follow that format.
Setting them up in that triangle formation is probably the most standard way that Maya built their cities.
We're going to take a short commercial break, and we'll be right back with you.
Up at the stars, I'm caught inside a loop where I can get to your heart, get to your heart.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Oh. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
My guest today is Dr. Edwin Barnard, and he is a field archaeologist. In 2010, he and a team of students went to Angkor Wat in Cambodia to study the temples that were designed to capture the sun at its highest point, a phenomenon known as the zenith passage. Hey, I want to continue on this sighting tube at Angkor Wat. Did you get a chance to see the light coming down during the zenith passage and hitting the lingam?
Oh, yes. Yes. I think I have pictures in that report I sent you.
Oh, actually, you do have a couple.
I have a couple of them. Some of them are knocked over because the other jewel box is underneath that altar. So okay. A lot of times they're knocked out of the way and there's just a big hole there because the looters would dig down knowing there was a jewel box without a hole in the middle underneath the altar.
Okay. So I reproduced it with black and white, so I didn't get the crispness. I need to go back and look at the quality of that. By the way, those of you listening, I will be posting these images on the Facebook page for you to look at in detail and get a quick, good idea with what we're talking about. Did the lingam enhance the light? Did something, or did it just bathe the lingam in light and that was it?
I mean, it didn't change its shape or anything. It certainly highlighted it. And it was, okay. You know, a brilliant, it was as if the lingam itself was glowing.
So it actually, yeah. I mean, because that's intense sunlight. So it would, you know, highlight anything. It's going to be like.
And it would have been so much better if it was the actual original tube instead of when they knock off that capstone, yeah. Then the hole in the roof is like, a foot or a foot and a half in diameter.
Okay.
With the capstone, it would have been more like 3 inches. So it would have been just like a laser beam.
It would have been a beam, a powerful beam. Yeah, I can see.
A few of them that I found were the capstone was still up there. I was only there for a short time. So first I had to figure it out. And then I only had one day to go find. So I was spreading out like, let's go find out which ones still have their capstone on them.
Oh, my God.
But now I've got a really good game plan. I'm going back in August, which we'll talk about.
Yeah, we'll have to get you while you're over there. Okay, so let's continue on with the Zenith Passage features that you're focused on. The nomads, we just talked about the sighting tubes. The archaeological orientation. Talk a little bit about the building orientation and why that's important.
It's a funny one. It is, you know, it's one of our main tools, right? Of figuring out whether a building is astronomically aligned, the building's alignment. But for the Mesoamericans, for sure, and I'm pretty sure for the Khmer, they were what we call horizon-based astronomers. They were not looking at the entire sky's bowl. They were focused on when things rose and set. So they would watch the horizon for exactly where the sun was when it was as farthest north. Well, that's when it rises farthest north, that's the day of summer solstice. When it's farthest south, it's winter solstice. So watching also planets rise and set and stars as well. So if we're looking for a building orientation for Zenith Passage, well, they can't, of course, orient it to straight up in the sky unless they put a big hole in the roof. So what they're doing is they're orienting the building to the point on the horizon where it will rise the day of Zenith Passage. So it'll rise there at that orientation and then go up and hit the center of the sky and then set. So if we're in the Maya area, especially, we found a number of buildings that are oriented to their own zenith or that one down at 15.6. There's a lot of them that seem to be honoring zenith passage somewhere else, which
is stop you real quickly at Chichen Itza at the El Caracol, the observatory. Is that, I mean, that building's tilted to the cardinal points. We know that, but are there any functions left on the, I mean, they put it together haphazardly, but is there any openings that let light in?
Not straight in, not from the very, well, not that we know of. I mean, the whole top is collapsing, completely blown up. We don't have the center of the, but we do know that one of its staircases is aligned to its zenith passage.
Really?
If you look at its plan view, it looks ugly because one staircase is tilted away from the other one, but one of them points at Venus and the other one points at zenith passage. And then one of the only surviving windows up top, that one looks at zenith passage at Copan's latitude, not Chichen Itza's.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
The same thing happens at Etzna and all over the place. It's a weird and Teotihuacan. They all seem to be talking about the zenith passage at 15.6 degrees latitude.
God, I'd love to get somebody excavating a ruin and finding a codice that's all about the zenith passage from the Maya.
I would love it. We need dates, though. We need dates and location. That's why it's so tricky, because I've got to know where it is and when.
Exactly. Let's continue on with these zenith passage features. The next one would be art and carved texts. These are Sanskrit texts that are on the wall. I guess they're on the wall of the entrance to Angkor Wat or something. And talk how are they influencing you in understanding the zenith passage?
Okay. That one in Angkor, it's in Angkor Wat. So it's within the city of Angkor, in Angkor Wat. That's a huge building. You walk forever from the front entrance to actually get to the main temple.
Really?
And along that walk, about halfway from when you walk in its front door to when you actually get to the temple, is a very long panel that shows basically that scene from Hindu mythology where the demons and the gods are having a tug of war.
Right.
And they're all lined up, and there's a number of them. And a researcher before Eleonora Manica noticed that the number of demons and gods lined up where the count of them was the right count to be solstices. So if the center was the equinox, the count of demons going out were the solstice.
So it wasn't that the light was hitting it. It was more that there was a marker for kind of
numerological.
Numerological. Okay.
But she didn't notice that within those long lines, there wasn't just there's the center part. Then there's little demons. And at the end, there's big demons and gods. But about midway through, there's also some larger than the rest. And those, I think, are naming they're marking the parts of zenith.
Okay.
Zenith happens in between equinox and solstice.
So it's not that the light's hitting it. It's more of a marker that says this is the time of year when the zenith passage happens at Angkor Wat.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that leads me to the final feature, which is numerology. You kind of gave us a hint. Are there other hints of numerology in separate temples that we will see if we go there?
The only one that I've seen so far that I've understood is that panel in Angkor Wat itself. And then there's a couple of little scenes that have the sun that may or may not connect. It's tricky to actually say it's zenith passage that they're talking about in an image.
Okay.
So mostly, you know, I've looked and looked at the art in Angkor Thom. I haven't seen anything that I could really even craft that argument with. That's not to say it's not there. Okay. I'm in the process of trying to figure this out.
Well, you're going back, so you must be impressed enough to want to head in the expense and go there with your research team or by yourself with a small group and follow up on your initial research. So
it takes so long to get there. My gosh, I think my plane ticket says 26 hours, and that only gets me to Bangkok. I've still got to get a hotel and wake up the next day and fly into Cambodia.
Oh my God. Yeah. I just finished a 22 hour flight. It's brutal. Well, this is fascinating, Ed. This is something that I didn't know, that these honeycomb temple crowns are hollow. They're open at the top to allow the light in, and more specifically, the zenith passage period, they're almost completely aligned for that. It's like they were built almost directly for that event, isn't it?
I don't know whether it's that's its primary function, but it certainly is one. It was very purposeful. It rains there constantly, so they had to just accept that rain's going to come in. It was more important to them to keep that hole open, unless maybe somebody in the distant past, they'd have some guy scramble up there with a cork and they'd cork it for part of the year. That could have been, the French actually corked the one in Angkor Wat itself. They said, oh, this is stupid. This hole lets water in and it's ruining the floor of the temple. I don't know why these silly Khmer people did it, but they put a big flag in. They corked it with a flag, the very top temple. But then tragically, the flagpole acted like a lightning rod and it blew the top of the temple off and they had to fix it. But they put the dang flag back in. It's still there today. They've corked it because they thought that the Khmer were just being stupid.
Well, when they had the capstones on, what were you saying? The capstone hole was about 3 inches in diameter, or was it bigger?
Yeah, about like that, about 3 inches in diameter. Depending on there are bigger and smaller temples. I bet
there's still water. Water's still going to get in there if it rains a lot, but maybe not the same amount of water.
Yeah, it wouldn't. And it depends on whether it's coming straight down and things. It would definitely drip in there, but I'm sure they'd have a myriad of ways to either appreciate that was happening or solve the problem. I mean, heck, they built the whole temple like they were going to get stumped by what to do about the hole.
Yeah, I mean, they're brilliant engineers. They must have figured it out. There must be drainage systems within the temple that are not perceived.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. No, I want to get into the mythology of Lanka and the Hindu prime meridian. But before I do that, I'm going to ask you flat out, what's your feeling on diffusion, Ed? Simply because we have two pyramid cultures. Obviously, the Maya pyramids are much different looking than the Cambodian, the Khmer pyramids. But a lot of people say that some of the design, it looks like it could have been a master blueprint that was distributed thousands of years ago. What do you say?
No. In a word.
I can't bend your arm, damn it. Okay.
I do think that it's a mixed bag. It's not in the specific case of did the Maya and the Khmer meet? I don't think so. Were there cases of diffusion? Absolutely. Much more so among old world cultures than from old world to new world. They had that whole ocean problem. But I think it's a mixed bag because some people use that same logic to take away the achievements of people like the Khmer or the Maya. And so, I have a knee-jerk reaction about just protecting the integrity of their civilization's achievements, that somebody didn't teach them how to do it. No, they were smart people who did it themselves. Mm-hmm. When it comes to pyramids, I mean, I think I've even said this on your show before. If you don't have cement or rebar anybody who's trying to build a tall building realizes that a stack of blocks falls over, but if you got a fat base going up to a skinny top, you make the tallest, most stable building. The pyramidal shape makes sense from a trial and error perspective. Okay. So that's why they're all over the world, because it's the tallest, most stable shape you can make when you're beginning in architecture.
Well, as a Mayanist, though, how do you, and I would think that you're much prefer the design of the Mayan pyramids, but what do you find attractive about the Khmer pyramid as it relates to a Maya pyramid?
You know, they are very similar. They have terraces. Both of them have terraces and oftentimes niches, and they have a central staircase going up the front. They are very, very similar. They are in similar locations and environments, though. They have, you know, a lot of limestone, a lot of water, a lot of trees. So the materials they're using would lend themselves to the similar shapes, unlike, you know, like Egypt had mostly, you know, sandstone and granite. They built different forms. The biggest of the pyramids don't have any terraces whatsoever. The early ones at you were there, Saqqara. They have some steps, but
Saqqara is a very strange place.
And if you go down to Peru, their temples are very different. The Moche, they're using mostly adobe bricks, but they're smoothing off the sides, and they're often using ramps instead of stairs. So, you know, I definitely acknowledge openly that the Maya pyramids and the Khmer pyramids are structurally very similar. It's interesting. I don't think they taught each other how to do it, but they were using the same materials and made very similar buildings.
I'm kind of going back to the thought of a mother culture distributing a blueprint to upstarts like the Khmers or like the early Mayas and saying, this is how you do it. Now figure it out.
One important difference is that the Maya ones almost always have a temple on top, and the Khmer ones never do. It's just the base and then a flat top. There's no temples that are up there.
Okay. All right. Well, there we go. So let's talk about the myth of Lanka and the Hindu prime meridian. Apparently, the Zenith Passage is first mentioned in the 6th century. But there is a myth that this land bridge that is connects Sri Lanka with India. Talk a little bit about what you know about that. It's a fascinating story.
Well, I really did. I kind of went down the rabbit hole on that one. I was trying to think, you know, why does Zenith matter to these guys? Where did they get their knowledge from? We know that the origins of Angkor was Hindu. So I looked at Indian examples, and the Ramayana is one of the most famous and beautiful of the
Vedic
stories.
Texts. Yeah.
And it talks about, you know, this bride getting stolen by a demon with multiple arms, and he goes down to this island. And then there's an adventure to go and get her back. At one point, Hanuman is creating a bridge across the ocean, and he falls in love with some underwater woman. And the story goes on and on. But there's a bridge that connects the mainland to this mythical island. And Sri Lanka has always been the default, that must be this island of Lanka that the Ramayana is talking about. I mean, it's named Sri Lanka. So, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? But in my perspective, looking at Zenith Passage, I looked at these things in terms of where you would see it. You've got the top line, the Tropic of Capricorn. That goes right through the major astronomical capital of Ujjain, which was destroyed by the Arabs. But that was an acknowledgement. I mean, the only way that we know about the line of the tropics, it is defined by the fact that if you step across it, you don't have zenith passage anymore. Mm-hmm. It can't be established without that fundamental understanding that is why it's where it's at. So Ujjain's there. And then the other really noticeable place, of course, is the equator.
Right.
At exactly at zero, the equinox is zenith passage. The day of equinox is the day of zenith passage. So I looked at those two and I looked, okay, well, Lanka does not work to be the zero line. We know that they had established one. The Hindus had established one. So where does work? And when I pulled that line, when I went down to that line and looked across, it's the very bottom island of the Maldives. The biggest bottom island of the Maldives hits exactly zero. And so I was looking at various maps of that area, and I noticed one that was showing me the seafloor. And on the bottom of the seafloor are two lines of islands that are totally submerged, but they are the balustrades of that bridge that Hanuman built to Lanka. There is an actual underwater bridge going to that island.
So do you go ahead?
Thor Heyerdahl actually found a bunch of Hindu ruins on that island and on the water around it. But the at that time Muslim government shut him down and would not let him publish or excavate those. They kept it quiet. He wrote a whole book about it.
Wow!
But they were there.
So your belief is that was at one time a man-made bridge from India to Sri Lanka?
No, I think that that at a moment where the water was lower, that chain of islands would have stuck out enough to be that bridge, not like a formally made bridge, mm-hmm. but that it would have stuck out to Hindu explorers. In the very distant past, I mean, the water had to be like at ice age levels. At the ice age level, I think that most of that bridge would be islands. I call it a bridge. It's not a bridge. It's just a formation of islands.
Well, you actually call it an underwater ridge.
Ridge.
Extending from the Maldives right up to Ujjain. But, you know, it's funny. If you look at this geological map, it looks like it's a ridge, but it looks like it could be a bridge of some kind.
It's kind of two paralleling ridges, isn't it? It looks like the two balustrades of a bridge.
Yeah. Maybe an early epic period when maybe the continents were together, you know, billions of years ago. Maybe it was part of a landform of some kind.
I was pretty surprised to find that, and I just kind of stumbled upon it. I was just looking, you know, as often is the case in archaeology, it's all about the question you ask. The evidence could be right in your face, but if you're not asking the right question, you don't see it.
I like the part where it says the bridge was built for Rama by an army of monkeys.
You know, I've continued this quest trying to figure out where this zenith passage comes. I went to Java, too. And in Java, on the east side of Java, I went to a play of the Ramayana and saw the parts where they were building the bridge. And then finally, they have this big fight on the island of Lanka and burn it down. And they actually burned the stage. It was intense. But they take that story very seriously, and they still enact it all the time today.
Mm, amazing.
It's so not just any old story. It's like a primary story.
It's an ancient Hindus, story that's kind of probably been around for
And Hindus kind of feel like it's, you know, one of the main parables for life.
Mm. So what's your follow-up plan when you leave in August? What do you want to do?
Well, I'm definitely, you know, it's part one of my privileges of being a independent archaeologist is I can do funny things like invite my high school friends with me. So that's, I'm bringing actually a bunch of my high school friends from 30 years ago.
Wow.
So it's part that trip. I'm showing them all my Zenith Passage stuff. But the big new thing is that we are going to go about 3 hours north into the jungle from Angkor to a site called Koh Kher. Almost every one of those Khmer ruins in all of Cambodia are cardinal aligned, north, south, east, west. So I can't find any of those building alignments to prove that Zenith Passage is depicted in them. But Koh Kher is perfectly aligned to Zenith. And it has a pyramid that's overlooking one of those complexes with the honeycombs with the holes in them. So I found it in the work of an Italian scholar, one of the only other guys doing astronomy in Angkor or in the Khmer. But August 16th is when I'll have to be there because we'll be 3 hours north and it won't be the same day as Angkor Zenith, which is nice. I can go back and I can see Angkor Zenith too. But I'm going to stand up on top of that pyramid and I'm going to take pictures that prove that the site is aligned. I've actually already done it. I have a friend over there and I hired him to go out there. It's not owned by the government. It's owned by some rich guy. So I made a deal with him and his guards. I've already paid them.
I was just going to ask you who you got to pay off to climb the top of a pyramid, because that's usually a no-no.
We're already at dawn. Me and my buddies are going to be on top of that pyramid at dawn, and we're going to stay in some village out there that my friend found me. But I had him go out there and arrange it all on the day and climb up. On April 25th. Which was the day of Zenith then, I had him go out there at dawn and take pictures. I was actually sitting in a hotel room in southern Campeche when his pictures started coming in through WhatsApp. And it's perfect. The alignment is totally true. I've seen it. He's taken pictures. I could just say, I got the pictures. I won't go. But no, I'm going.
Wow.
I'm going. And we're going to be on top of that pyramid and showing the first real Khmer alignment to Zenith Passage.
And how far is this location from Angkor Wat?
About 3 hours.
Oh, so it's pretty far.
We're going to go north to Kulen Mountain, where the first king of the Khmer was crowned, and then we'll keep going north to Koh Kher and stay in these little houses in a village my buddy found us.
We're going to have you back to talk about that, because that sounds like a fantastic trip and exploration.
Cross your fingers that it's not a cloudy day for me. I'll have come a long ways to not see the sun.
And it's been a pleasure as always. I got a real education on this Zenith Passage, what it's all about. I think there's little missing parts of it too. I'd love for you to talk to a shaman in that area and ask them what they know about it and what their understanding is, just to get a sense of if they went into ceremony, if they use psychotropic drugs to anoint the day or connect with the gods, the energies, whatever.
You know, one interesting thing I did see in my lifetime was two Maya villages up in Chiapas. Those guys made themselves gnomons again in the modern main plazas and were talking on their cell phones to each other, saying, okay, it's perfect here on my mine.
Wow.
Is it perfect on yours? No. How much shadow do you have? So they were actually talking back and forth, the villages of Chamula and Zinakantan, which are about 20 miles distance from each other.
Okay.
And they were testing themselves when exactly Zenith Passage was. Why? I don't know. But they made the gnomons in modern times and were talking on their cell phones back and forth to prove that they were different.
You're piquing our interest on the Zenith Passage, Ed. Come on now. You got to stretch a little bit and get the shamanistic point of view.
We got to ask them, I guess.
All right. Hey, a great pleasure. And thank you for taking the time. I know you must be exhausted after your long drive
I'm fired up. I'm gonna build my couch now after this.
Hey, well, hey, great success on your new place. I know it's a work in progress, but hey, I thank you for taking the time out to join me today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me again. We'll talk again soon.
Hey there, Dr. Ed Barnhart here, inviting you to listen to my new podcast, Archaeo Ed. It's a podcast about the ancient civilizations of the Americas. You know, the ones that Western history books spend about a paragraph or two discussing. For the last 30 years, I've been all over the Americas as an archaeologist, an explorer, and a seeker of esoteric knowledge. Archaeo Ed is just me, freed from the lecture podium and talking like we're just having a beer together. So if you're a fan of ancient cultures of the Americas, join me as I theorize and pontificate. You can find Archaeo Ed wherever you look for podcasts. That's Archaeo Ed, ArchaeoEd. Give me a listen. You'll be happy you did.
There was a lot to like in that interview with Ed. It's always a pleasure to have him on the program. He does think out of the box. He is obviously also a traditionalist. And I think, and I think you might agree too, if you've been listening to Earth Ancients long enough, that he left a lot on the table. What are the shamanistic rituals that are performed during this zenith passage? We know, and I know from my mentor, Humbats Min, who was a Mayan daykeeper, that these high points in the sun were worshipped. There were celebrations. There were meditations. We don't know how detailed a lot of these meditations were, but these seasonal changes were deeply revered, not only for the changes in the seasons, but also the physical changes that take place. What happens to our physiology during these high periods? What tests have been done? And, you know, also geomagnetic readings. What happens to the Earth? Is there changes in the fault lines? Is there changes in the ley lines, the energy points, the telluric fields? Are these temples built over ley lines that create energy when the sun beam comes down through the top of the temple into the interior? Is it, and it hits this lingam, this male-female symbol. Does anything happen? Is it just an optical illusion that we see? I mean, there's so much that is left unanswered. And, you know, archaeology today has this disconnect with the residents. What are the Khmer that are alive today in these regions? How do they celebrate? It's not captured in the information collection that these scientists do. And so, I mean, there is there's no collection of local rituals. There's no collection of the shamanistic look and celebration. And there's just so much more that appears to be missing from this analysis. Now, I was flabbergasted when I found out that archaeologists, the Mayanists, do not speak with local people. There's over 6 million Maya that still are with us today in Mexico and in Central America. And to not talk with them leaves us with a huge void in the potential knowledge that we could have on rituals, ceremonies, personal changes, and connecting with the ancestors. And that can mean a whole bunch of different things. So I would love to know how the Khmer celebrate these zenith passages. How do the Maya celebrate zenith passages? So I do know from my own mentor that the solar ceremonies that were practiced were to enhance the body, mind, and spirit. They did group meditations in Maya land. That can be any Mayan city in Mexico or Central America.
And some of the buildings were designed to enhance meditation, enhance without the use of psychotropic, psychedelic drugs, to enhance these periods of solar celebrations. So much more we needs to be captured in this. And so there you go. I think this is important information, but there's a lot that we don't know that could be added to a branch of archaeology. Now, we talked a little bit about archaeoastronomy, which is, you know, growing and growing and growing, but there needs to be more of a humanistic side of these sciences, not necessarily inviting psychics, but maybe, you know, people who understand the vibrational geomagnetic fields can use technology to capture this. And then talking to the shaman, talking to the day keepers, the solar scientists who are the local natives who understand and have practiced ceremony for thousands of years in these places. So anyhow, that was a great deal of fun to hear. Hey, if you're enjoying Earth Ancients, Destiny, or even our special edition, The Archives, please consider becoming a subscriber. For as little as $5 a month, you can support the work we do here on the program. And I got to tell you, we got bills. We got lots of bills. Things are really growing in price and labor and so forth and so on. And your monthly generous donation of $5, $10, $15, even $20 makes a huge difference. To become a subscriber to Earth Ancients, go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/Earth Ancients. It really, really helps. And, you know, don't have to worry about it. You give them a credit card. They deduct it without you even thinking about it. And that money goes towards the running of our production of each of these shows. Hey, we also got a whole bunch of gifts for you. We have e-books, downloadable books. We're up to about 25 now. We post a new e-book every 30 to 60 days. We also have unedited, unpublished interviews, some galleries. Occasionally I get on and we do a conversation and kind of touch on some of the current events, and it's all great and we thank you for it, but we have a lot of gifts for you too. So check it out. For more information, go to patreon.com/Earth Ancients. Hey, don't forget our Mexico tour coming up Labor Day week, September 2nd through the 12th. This is a chance to see some of the most remarkable Mayan temples in the world. We're going to be in Palenque. Oh, yeah, we're also going to be in Olmecland, right after we spend some time in Mexico City. We'll see a number of the ruins as well as major museums. Then we bus to Palenque. And then from there, it is an eye-opening exploration of Mayan culture from the ancient past. For more information, go to earthancients.com/tours, and you will see the entire itinerary. Get your deposit in. We're getting close to filled. We're only taking a few people, and it's important that you get your deposit in. Or you can just send me an email with more questions at cliff@earthancients.com. Come out and join us. Our tours are a blast. They're eye-opening. And come out and join us. All right, that's it for this week's program. I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Edward Barnard. It's great to have you, Ed. As always, our team of Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and everybody who makes this thing happen. You guys rock! All right, take care, be well, and we'll talk to you next time.